Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Welcome to Africa Link. This Friday, the 11th of May, 2018. I'm Jane Ayeko Kumet.
And I am Abubakar Jallo. We are coming to you live from our studios in Bonn, Germany.
Coming up on the program today, Kenya joins four other African countries that have launched satellites into space.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Okay, go!
The countdown as Kenya launched its first made satellite and the process was watched in Nairobi.
This is a journey we have started to develop higher capacity and to develop the technology to enable Kenya participate in space exploration and in space science.
And the World Health Organization grapples with fears about difficulty in stamping out the deadly Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
The problem here is that we already have three separate locations that are reporting cases that cover as much as 60 kilometers. We have three healthcare workers infected and one who've been reported as of yesterday as having died.
These are some of the stories that we've lined up for you, but first, here's a chance to listen to other stories shaping the world today.
I'm Shay Meineke with DW News. World Health Organization officials said Friday that they hope to deploy an experimental Ebola vaccine in the Democratic Republic of Congo after government authorities confirmed an outbreak of the deadly virus earlier this week in the country's northwest. At least 17 people have died. WHO Emergency Response Chief Peter Salama told a UN briefing in Geneva that they're preparing for the worst.
It seemed that the government is actively exploring the use of the vaccine, and we're waiting for final authorization. I expect to receive that in the coming days. So we are very concerned, and we are planning for all scenarios, including the worst-case scenario.
Also in the DRC, the United Nations Children's Fund has reported that hundreds of thousands of children have been suffering from malnutrition in the country's Kasai region due to ongoing conflict between militia and government forces. UNICEF spokesman Christophe Boulirac made this statement to reporters.
We have now children coming back from the bush after months of violence in a very bad nutritional situation. We think that 770,000 children suffer from acute malnutrition, including 400,000 children who suffer from severe acute malnutrition. These are not new numbers, but it's extremely serious to see that the funds are not here.
UNICEF has appealed for more than 70 million euros to provide assistance in Kasai, but said that only around 25% has so far been raised. In Kenya, the country's chief prosecutor has ordered an official investigation into the cause of a dam burst on Wednesday that killed at least 44 people in the Rift Valley. Nordin Haji said he hoped the probe would establish cause and culpability, adding that he would file a report in 2 weeks. The Kenyan Red Cross estimates that at least 500 families were affected by the disaster. This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. The health ministry in the Gaza Strip says Israeli soldiers shot dead one Palestinian protester and wounded at least 40 others during Friday protests at the border with Israel. An estimated 40 protesters have been killed and 1,700 others wounded since weekly border protests began in late March. Palestinians are calling for an end to a decade-old blockade of what they claim is their territory, while Israel insists on its right to defend its borders. Meanwhile, Iran has rejected accusations by Israel that it had fired rockets on Israeli positions in the Golan Heights, a Syrian border area controlled by Jerusalem. Iran also criticized the international community for not condemning Israeli airstrikes on Iranian targets in Syria on Thursday. The UN has called for a halt on all hostile attacks between Israel and Iranian forces. And finally, Kenya joined the club of emerging space nations in Africa on Friday after a nanosatellite designed by the University of Nairobi was launched into space. The satellite, which was designed to provide audio broadcast, was launched in cooperation with Japan from the International Space Station. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.com. I'm Shay Meineke.
You are listening to DW's Africa Link. I am Abubakar Jalo.
And I'm Jane Ayeko Kumet.
Now, let's start with some positive news. Kenya has launched its first locally produced satellite into space. The nanosatellite, which was developed by the University of Nairobi, will be the first outer space object registered by the East African nation.
Now, Kenya desires to venture into the space race, joining other four African countries who already have satellite in the orbit. Now, these countries include Ghana, Nigeria, Angola, and South Africa. The launch itself took place at the International Space Station, but was viewed live in Nairobi, where Ruben Chama sent us this report.
10, 9, 8, 7.
Kenya's miniature satellite, named 1QUNSPF, blasted off at the International Space Station, along with two others, mini satellites designed by Costa Rica and Turkey. The satellite is only 10 centimeters high and able to provide limited Earth observation and audio broadcast. Dr. Faith Karanja is the chairperson of the Department of Geospatial and Space Technology at the University of Nairobi.
Really, when you think about space technology, we have actually been users of the technology as a country. We have really never gone into the nitty-gritties of, you know, getting to know how satellites are built and what goes into those boxes and all that. But right now, we are very proud because now we know what it takes to build those satellites.
The Cube satellite was developed at the University of Nairobi as part of a global program of the United Nations Office for Outer Space Affairs. It is designed to boost the work done in developing countries, especially in Africa, with the improved access to space resources provided by the Japanese. Jackson Budhia is the Dean of School of Engineering at the University of Nairobi, whose team watched the launch in Japan.
This is a journey we have started to develop higher capacity and to develop the technology to enable Kenya participate in space exploration and in space science. And we believe that the University of Nairobi can provide the required leadership to enable Kenyans become operators in space.
The Embassy of Japan in Kenya, in collaboration with the government of Kenya, organized a public viewing of the satellite's deployment into space. Lucy Ruto was among many Kenyans who came out to witness the historic moment.
Personally, I feel very excited because this is a new frontier we are entering, that other countries are already here, which means that if Kenya, we are going into this, it means that this is just the beginning of better things to come.
Kenya is now hoping to launch its own space program at the cost of between $500,000 and $1 million per year. This includes the cost of design, manufacture, and gradual setting up of the requisite laboratories, as Professor Isaac Mbeche, acting vice chancellor of the University of Nairobi, explains.
We expect that the University of Nairobi will get part of the fund to come and support efforts we have started to start developing bigger satellites, which will be of bigger commercial value to the country. We will require quite a bit of funding from the government as well as from the private sector.
And that report was compiled by Ruben Kiama in Nairobi.
Yes, and certainly you, our followers, have already sent in your opinion, your feelings, your excitement about this story. For instance, Penda Jobe from Banjul in the Gambia says it's really a great move for Kenya.
And we have Awia Banaba says, what I have to say to Kenyans is to keep up the good work and remember the sky is merely the limit to what you see.
And Wisdom from Liberia says, Africa will get better someday. Thanks to the Kenyan government for the job. Well done. That's interesting.
And the final one from Capo Daniel, who says, all the countries that had launched satellites into space are African countries, former British colonies. This shows how French France is holding Africa backward. Well, I think I disagree with that because Angola was not a former British colony, so it's South Africa.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Elsewhere in the world, but still in Africa, within the neighborhood of Kenya, that is in the Democratic Republic of Congo, 10 days after the first case of Ebola was reported, health officials have not yet been able to contain it, despite a swift response from the World Health Organization and DRC's health ministry.
Now, the WHO says it is seeking Congo's approval to use Merck vaccine as fears arise over a possible spread to town within 1 million inhabitants. The organization plans to fly in 20 to 40 experts over the weekend to the affected area, which is 15 hours motorbike drive from the closest town and has absolutely their infrastructure.
Yes, now the World Health Organization Deputy Director General of Emergency Preparedness, Peter Salama, said stepping out the outbreak is going to be a tough and costly program. Take a listen.
Even though it's a remote rural area, which is usually gives us a sense of reassurance in terms of spread of an outbreak, the problem here is that we already have three separate locations that are reporting cases that cover as much as 60 kilometres and maybe more. We have three healthcare workers infected and one who've been reported as of yesterday as having died. And we know that healthcare workers can really be an amplification factor for these kinds of outbreaks. And we know the number of suspected, probable and confirmed cases is significant. So we are very concerned and we are planning for all scenarios.
That was the WHO Deputy Director General of Emergency Preparedness, Peter Salama. Actually, he also said this is a highly complicated, sophisticated operation in one of the most difficult terrains on Earth. Anyways,
we can only hope for the best in the DRC, but you too have been sharing your comments with us. For instance, Charles Ongole from Uganda says, I can't resolutely say yes or no, they should try the vaccine, but maybe it is a good way to go. And again, Wisdom says, why not let them go ahead? Because avoiding the vaccine cannot help save the lives of those under critical conditions now.
Thanks for those responses. I think we'll get to them if we have the time. Anyways, let's move on to another story. The Gambia will tomorrow go to the polls to elect mayors and area council chairpersons. 38 candidates, including two women, are contesting for 8 seats across the country.
This is the first time in the history of the Gambia that women take part in mayoral elections. DW's Omar Wali sent us this report.
Campaign for Saturday's election is over and candidates are cooling down. This is the only physical campaigns in public places, but with today's technology, it is not yet over. Some candidates have taken to the social media to persuade undecided voters. Oftentimes, mayoral elections are not as important as presidential, but for the Gambia after the fall of Yahya Jammeh, this election speaks volume.
Such a race has been rare in the country for so many years, having so many young people that are in the race, particularly two women that are contesting in Banjul. And it is very, very important for every Gambian to know that this is one of the most important elections. I would say even more important than the presidential and parliamentary elections.
Well, tomorrow's election is very important, especially for the local people, because municipalities are the ones that are directly connected to the local people. So it is very important, and I hope Gambians would not sit back home and refuse to go and vote, because this is an election that, they're going to elect direct representatives.
Like most African countries, people mostly vote on ethnic grounds other than competence. This election comes at a time when the country is grappling with heavy debt caused by the ex-president Yahya Jammeh's luxurious lifestyle. The government is now selling several planes and fleet of luxury cars bought by the former president.
Omar Wale with that report in the Gambia.
Now let's get to some of your responses to the story that aired before this one. That is the deadly Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. A response here from Junior Mensah. He says, Ebola again on the African soil?
And Morina says, why only in Africa? That's not something pleasant. That's not all. We have another one coming in from Abel Nkwene. He says, I think there are better ways to ensure the limitation of the virus in the affected areas, such as issuing travelling limitations.
That's in response to whether the vaccine, this trial vaccine, should be used in this treatment of the Ebola outbreak there in the DRC.
Certainly the World Health Organization is upbeat to it, and we hope something good happens. Keep your comments coming. We will read them.
If you are just joining us, this is Africa Link with me, Abubakar Jalo.
And I'm Jane Ayeko-Kumet. Do remember that Africa Link is also live on Facebook, so you do not have to be glued to your radio. You can check out Facebook on your iPhone, on your smartphone, whichever type.
And also
type.
Leave us a response.
Certainly. And do share the program.
Definitely. Now, coming up in this half of the program, we look into the pioneering figure, Hendrik Witbooi, who led Namibia to independence.
I think if we think of his legacy, we should think of his vision of unifying people, of unifying different tribes to stand against any threat from outside.
That report will be coming in shortly in our series of African Roots, plus your Friday dose of the German Bundesliga analysis.
That's right. Stay tuned to this program. But first, in Zambia, teachers and all those intending to enroll for teacher training courses will now be required to undertake an aptitude test. This follows a revelation that hundreds of practicing teachers are poorly qualified.
And this requirement takes effect immediately, or rather starting with the intake of 2018. So far, 500 teachers have been relieved of their services. As Kathy Short found out, this cleanup exercise is still ongoing.
It is break time at Kabulonga Girls Primary School, and the pupils are busy playing. Kabulonga is one of the many government schools that attract non-qualified teachers. In 2016, the government published a report indicating that 60% of pupils in some provinces are unable to read and write. This prompted the government to take action. One of the immediate measures is to subject teachers and those who want to enroll for a teaching career to undertake an aptitude test.
There have been complaints that the levels of functional literacy and numeracy expected of one who has graduated from a college is not up to the standards. What has been happening in the recent past was that simply those that would want to join the teaching service, they'll simply apply and attach their credentials, and we simply look at their credentials, and once we are satisfied that they are genuine, then they are employed.
That was Stanley Mhango, chairperson of the Teaching Service Commission, a government regulatory body for teachers. In 1991, the government liberalized teacher training, resulting in the mushrooming of private training schools, some of which are accused of producing poorly trained teachers. Juliet Chibuta, a parent, shared her sentiments about the saga with me.
I think it's very sad because, you know, the teachers are supposed to be the ones to educate the nation. So if they have fake qualifications, it's a concern in the nation. It means that somewhere, somehow, we haven't done something. We're supposed to put some valves somewhere and close and ensure that people who are not qualified are not supposed to be teachers.
Deborah Chanda was a teacher at Kabulonga Girls Primary School, but her services were discontinued after she was discovered to possess fake documents.
At some point, my students were not passing, so they found me out and they knew that I didn't have the qualifications and they had fired me. I do regret going to that school and embarrassing myself like that.
Chanda is among the 500 teachers fired by the government for having fake qualifications during a scrutiny exercise across the country. The affected teachers are now being prosecuted in the courts of law. Cosmas Mukuka, Secretary General of the Zambia Congress of Trade Unions, the umbrella body that represents teachers in the country, says the problem is beyond private teacher colleges.
teacher training is organized in such a way that it has got teaching practice as part of the orientation. Now, when you say aptitude tests, are you training the teacher to teach or to do aptitude tests? Because the issue is simple. Teachers are supposed to demonstrate and are supposed to teach. That's why there's teaching practice where teachers score and they are graded in that order.
That report was prepared by Kathy Schott.
Now, on Facebook, we've been asking, how did they even get the jobs in the first place? And do you relate with this in your home country? We have a response here from Clement Raphael Banda from Lusaka. He says, I think this is exaggeration on the part of the teaching council which made that statement.
Okay, somebody sharing his comments there also in Lusaka. Idris from Kaduna in Nigeria says, yes, in Kaduna, the government in Nigeria conduct primary 4 tests for teachers and were conducted, and all of them failed. Now we have new teachers.
And Hussein from Mauritania says, oh yes, we suffer from this phenomenon too much, and the consequences are obvious, which are bad education, ignorance, diseases, unconscious generation.
But from the Gambia, Batiz Barrow says, we have pretty good teachers in urban schools, but in rural schools, it's a different scenario.
And Nicholas Conto says it's also happening in Ghana. Anyways, thanks for your responses.
DW, African Roots.
Namibia was one of the last African countries to gain its independence. When the Republic of Namibia was finally proclaimed in 1990, it was a culmination of a long struggle for self-determination that began in the 19th and early 20th century with the resistance against German colonization.
Now, one of the heroes of that time is Hendrik Witbooi. His story was written by Victoria Averill and presented by Benita van Eisen.
Namibia's banknotes are a perfect way to start this history lessons. Many of them bear a face of Hendrik Witbooi. He was a revered warrior who led a group of people called the Nama to fight the German colonizers. The notes are a daily reminder of Witbooi, also known by an indigenous name which translates as snake in the grass because of his guerrilla tactics. A young Nama woman remembers.
My grandmother, when I was younger, and she would send me like to go pick up her money for her, like at a friend's place or wherever that she loaned money. She'd always tell me, "Kumo ese isinqansi basi ubaje," and that loosely translates to "go and get the nqansi for me." And I'm like, "Grandma, what?"
Hendrik Witbooi was born around 1830 into a revered family of Nama people, a once nomadic tribe of pastoralists living in southwest Africa. His Nama community later permanently settled in southern Namibia. There, Witbooi gained a reputation as a warrior who battled repeatedly with the neighboring Herero people. But when the German colonizers expanded into Nama and Herero lands in the 1890s, Witbooi quickly changed tactics. He called on his Herero enemies to unite against the Germans. In 1893, the Germans launched an attack on Witbooi's village, killing scores of people. This caused Hendrik Witbooi to change tactics again. He signed a peace agreement with the Germans, even supplying Nama warriors to fight against other tribes. But a decade later, Witbooi had enough. In 1904, the aging warrior led the Nama in a rebellion against the Germans, dying in battle a year later. The Germans went on to virtually exterminate the Nama and the Herero in what is considered to be one of the first genocides of the 21st century. The Herero and Nama rebellion might have failed, but Witbooi's call for a united resistance cemented his reputation as a great leader. Former politician Anton von Wittesheim says this is an important lesson for Namibia today.
I think if we think of his legacy, we should think of his vision of unifying people, of unifying different tribes to stand against any threat from outside. And tribalism and racism for us in Namibia is definitely a serious threat for our common future.
Beyond his face on Namibia's banknotes and streets bearing his name, Hendrik Witbooi left his mark in another way. One of his diaries, where he penned his thoughts as well as copies of letters and meetings, has survived. The journal shows Witbooi's prophetic insights into the menace of colonialism. The role Hendrik Witbooi played in the Namibian struggle has received international recognition. As for his letters and diaries, they have been included in UNESCO's Memory of the World Register as Documentary World Heritage.
And that report was compiled by Victoria Avril and presented by Benita von Eisen.
And as usual, on Friday, we take a look ahead of the weekend action in the German Bundesliga football tournament. With the last day of the season fast approaching, more than half of the league still has something to play for.
Now, from the Champions League to relegation, who needs what on the last day of the German Bundesliga? Matthew Ford was in the studio earlier with me, and we started talking about Hoffenheim and Borussia Dortmund, who are fighting for a spot at the Champions League.
Yeah, well, it's come down to the final day of the season, and this is something of a final between Hoffenheim and Dortmund for that final Champions League space. They play each other in Hoffenheim. However, Dortmund go into the game 3 points clear. In fact, it could end up with them both qualifying. Dortmund need a point to make their Champions League qualification absolutely certain. However, Hoffenheim are good at home. They've been good in the second half of the season, and they'll feel confident of getting a result. A draw for them should be enough because of their goal difference. However, a win at home against Dortmund would ensure that they go straight in to the Champions League. This year, of course, it's even more important because for the first time, the fourth place team in the Bundesliga will go straight in to next season's Champions League without having to play a qualifying round, which is where Hoffenheim fell short last year against Liverpool.
It's actually a fascinating performance there for Julian Nagelsmann's team. Now let's talk about RB Leipzig. They're struggling this season to get into the Champions League as well.
It's been a difficult one for them. Obviously, they took the league by storm last year, of course, and qualified for the Champions League, but were knocked out in the group stages. And then, of course, they were also knocked out of the Europa League as well. And it seems that they've struggled to adapt to having to get used to playing Bundesliga one week, then European football during the week. And they've not quite adapted to that just as well. On the final day of the season, they face a trip away to Hertha Berlin, which is a very winnable fixture. However, even if they do win and Hoffenheim draw against Dortmund, even a win won't be enough for RB Leipzig. So they, at the end of this weekend, they may have to be content with a Europa League place.
It's going to be a fascinating weekend for the Bundesliga, don't you think?
Yeah, mainly down the bottom, I think. That's where the biggest story is, of course. I think for the fourth or fifth year in a row, Hamburg are still fighting against relegation. They remain the only founding member of the Bundesliga who have never been relegated from the league in over 54 years. However, this time, it's looking less and less likely. They go into their final day with a match at home against Borussia Mönchengladbach, which they have to win to have any chance whatsoever. But their survival fate is not in their hands anymore. Even if they do win, they have to hope that relegated Cologne can beat Wolfsburg away. If Wolfsburg get as little as a point, it'll be irrelevant what Hamburg do at home. So the fate's not in their hands.
It's looking very scary for Wolfsburg as well.
I said, they know, but at least they know the fate's in their hand. They know that they've got Cologne at home. Cologne are already relegated. They've got nothing else to play for.
And they're
going to
celebrate
pride.
It inside.
They're going to celebrate their relegation in style. Yeah. 2,500 Cologne fans are going to be travelling to Wolfsburg. But they know that there's nothing to play for. So Wolfsburg know that they can get a point and that'll be enough to keep them in the league. However, the team who doesn't manage it will most likely go into a relegation playoff against the third place team from the second division, which this year is Holstein Kiel. And they will then play a playoff against each other to determine who will have that final Bundesliga place for next season.
DW Sports editor Matthew Ford speaking to me earlier.
Now, in Cameroon, that's a story that we've been covering on our social media. In Bouay, which is southwestern of Cameroon, residents there say they are living in fear because of government forces that are moving around burning houses in Anglophone regions. And we asked, when will this end?
Well, if you want to see that detailed report, visit our Facebook page, DW Africa. Now, Sophia Heritage wrote, thank you, Adrian, for that coverage. Ambazonia must be free because this territory has never officially been part of French Cameroon.
And another one called Freedom says Southern Cameroonians must be free.
And a WhatsApp user says, we in Bamenda live in fear, especially those Batibo. We see corpses killed and abandoned every day by the military, yet the government is doing nothing about it. The best president could say is it to call us terrorist cult. I'm not going anyway, sir. That's a bit of a roughing point there.
That's all we had time for now. My name is Jane Ayeko Kumet.
And I'm Abubakar Jalo.
Have a pleasant weekend.
Bye now.